Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
I'm your host, and we have a fantastic show for you today. Bob Kessler, executive producer extraordinaire, will tell us more.
We got some big news here from a big car maker, and it could have big green implications because of the kind of cars they might not be making any longer. A good friend, Tom Appel, will tell us more.
Big green implications? I want to learn more. All coming up on this edition of Green Sense. Four-door sedans are as American as apple pie and baseball, and the company that did more than anyone else when it comes to American automobile manufacturing will soon be phasing them out. Here to tell us more about this big bombshell of an announcement from Ford is Consumer Guide Automotive publisher Tom Appel. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
Can you believe Ford is phasing out their four-door sedans? How surprised were you when you heard this news?
You know, both surprised and not surprised. It's actually interesting to know just how few sedans Ford actually sells anymore and how few sedan models that they actually have. But that said, if you're just anyone who's been around cars for as long as I have, it's stunning that the sedan is finally being ushered out to pasture.
Well, put that in context, Tom. How many sedans does Ford produce per year?
Do they produce per year? I don't have a total for all the cars they produce, but I do have an interesting number for you. The Ford Fusion, for example, used to be Ford's best-selling car for a while, and it was selling about 250 to almost 300,000 units a year. It's now down to about 150,000 units a year, and probably going to fall below that this year. So that's in the once critical midsize sedan market, which used to dominate, but now small crossovers have easily eclipsed that in sales.
What would you guess their total production for four-door sedans is?
If I was just going to come up with a top-of-mind number, probably 400,000-ish, maybe 500,000.
So that's still a lot of cars. Will this create a void in the supply of sedans, causing prices either to rise, or does this create an opportunity for Ford's competitors to fill?
Both, plus a third thing. I think that what's going to happen is right now sedans by virtually every manufacturer, at least non-luxury sedans, are being sold with heavy incentives. Once those incentives disappear, a lot of the reasons that people are turning those instead of crossovers are going to disappear. So you're going to see increased interest in crossovers, I think, once very cheap sedans are removed from the market.
So what does this do to drivers' habits? Will people be driving bigger cars or smaller cars?
The transition right now, and the most common market move right now, is for people to trade in a midsize sedan and then swap it for a compact crossover. And I've heard specifically from Honda folks that when people trade in an Accord, they either buy another Accord or they buy a Honda CR-V. That's a very popular move. Additionally, that's, you're seeing that a little bit at Toyota where people are turning in Camrys and going to RAV4s. And at Ford, they sell a lot of Escapes, which is their compact crossover. So that's really the migration. So you are seeing people go to a vehicle that actually has a slightly smaller footprint than the vehicle they were getting out of.
Pickup trucks, where do they fit in the equation? Are people going from sedans to pickup trucks?
Not so much. There was 2-3 years ago, this is probably a little bit more true. We saw a renaissance of the compact midsize pickup. Honda got back into the market with a brand new Ridgeline, and you saw that Chevy and GMC redesigned their Colorado and Canyon, and they're much more consumer friendly and a lot more livable now than they used to be. And some of those were siphoning people out of cars, but I don't think that migration is happening anymore. Increasingly, I think you're seeing pickup truck buyers decide between large and midsize pickups.
Well, one of the good things about the sedans is that a lot of them were fairly green with good gas mileages. What does that do to the green cars? Are we going to start to see a backslide to more energy-consumptive vehicles?
That's a great question, Robert, and the answer is kind of, sort of. one of the things that manufacturers have been arguing with the government about is that this 2025 standard that everyone's afraid of, that's the one where manufacturers have to hit 54.5 mpg combined by CAFE standards, was a little bit hard to reach because people had been migrating to crossovers. And if you do a comparison between a Ford Fusion, the sedan, and the Ford Escape, the crossover that a lot of those people will probably be migrating to, you'll see that the fuel economy drops by about 1 mpg. So it's not a huge drop, but there is a small drop there. So to answer your question, yeah, a little bit. It's not this huge detriment to fuel economy that I think everyone thinks it is, because SUVs and crossovers just aren't as thirsty as they used to be.
Is this Ford taking a lead, or is this a trend and we're going to start to see other car companies follow suit?
More quietly, other manufacturers have already sort of done this. Chrysler, FCA, no longer sells the Chrysler 200 midsize sedan or the Dart compact sedan. And General Motors has suggested, I don't know if any of these are confirmed, that they're going to eliminate a number of sedans from their lineup. The Impala, the Malibu, for example, are supposed to be on the chopping block sometime soon. Those aren't confirmed. It's just a rumor that's swirling around. So I think that all the major manufacturers see the writing on the wall for sedans. And I don't think sedans are going to go away entirely. I just think it's going to become a much smaller segment. And I think a lot of it will be devoted to fleet.
Again, it's exemplary of the change that the world's going through. And things are constantly shifting out there. So we'll keep an eye on this. You're listening to Green Sense. I'm Robert Colangelo. My guest is Consumer Guide Automotive Publisher Tom Appel. We're talking about this shift in Ford from sedans to other vehicles. And we're going to touch on another topic. Well, Tom, we normally talk about cars themselves, but we don't talk very much about driving habits and how that can impact your gas mileage. And I see Consumer Guide Automotive recently published 5 habits to break for better gas mileage. So I thought these are worth sharing with our audience. I'll name a habit, and maybe you can give a further explanation of why that is good and how you do it. So does that sound okay?
Absolutely.
Well, the first one, and you're going to have to explain this one. Stopping.
Yes. One of the fundamental truisms of energy consumption in a vehicle is that it takes all the car's effort to get up to speed. So once you're up to speed, you don't want to stop if you don't have to. Now, that sounds dangerous, and I'm not encouraging anyone to swerve out of a lane or something like that, but it isn't that hard to sort of become proactive and look in front of you and see that, well, there's a big truck in front of me that's probably going to be stopping at the next light. I could probably get into the next lane and not stop. And anything you can do that keeps you at a steady pace improves your fuel economy.
Well, one of the fundamentals of driving is whatever goes, stops. So I'm glad you clarified that one. Well, here's another one that is tied into that one. Stop. Yes. Braking.
Yeah, and this is practically, and I hope she's not listening, this is a note to my mother. Because she's one of those people that drives with her foot hovering over the brake and responds too quickly to threats and potential situations. And she's on the brake as much as she's on the gas. And that's just a terrible thing to do for gas mileage.
Well, and aren't cars coming up with devices that help manage people that put their foot on the gas and the brake?
Not so much that manage that. You do have now a number of braking systems that will detect obstacles in the path and will apply the brake or let you know that you should apply the brake. But yeah, ultimately braking your pace, again, is just the worst thing to do for fuel economy.
And as you said earlier, it's all about anticipation, you know, being able to look around and engage your slowing down. All right, here's another one. Stop surging.
Yeah, I have a particular friend in mind when I thought about this one. But there are people who like to, instead of steady state driving on the highway, will apply some gas, drop down a little bit, apply the gas again, and drop down a little bit. And again, that's one of those things where you're changing speed. And ultimately, every time you ask the engine to do just a little bit more work than it was doing, you're burning a lot of gas because you're changing speed. So if you can keep a constant throttle and just maintain speed, or best case scenario, use cruise control, you're going to save a lot of gas.
Tom, I think you're making a good argument here for autonomous cars. They can do all these things very steadily and consistently where humans are anything but consistent.
That's funny, right? I had not considered that when this was originally authored, but you're exactly right.
All right,
this autonomous vehicle should be more fuel efficient.
The next one you're going to have to explain, stop creeping.
Yeah, this is a thing I run to, and I'm always sort of pushing back against my commute because I commute about an hour each way each day, and I find myself in situations at stoplights where people stop too soon and then slowly idle up during the 2 minutes they're waiting for the light to go green, and it's a tragic waste of gas to keep doing that. Now modern stop-start systems that actually shut off your engine while you're stopped, that pretty much solves this problem.
And this last one, you'll have to explain that. Stop snacking? What does that have to do with gas mileage?
That's almost a note to myself. I need to stop. I'm both my commute to work and back from work. I need some sort of cold caffeine. So I spend time in a drive-through waiting for a Diet Coke or a Diet Pepsi or an iced tea, and that's really not good for gas mileage.
Well, Tom, you always amaze us with your facts and information and your breadth of knowledge in cars. Thank you for joining us again. And we'll look forward to having you back on in a couple of weeks.
Looking forward to it.
That's Consumer Guide Automotive publisher Tom Appel with some news about Ford four doors and their demise and 5 driving habits to stop doing to save fuel. Read more about them at consumerguide.com. This is Robert Colangelo. You're listening to Green Sense. Subscribe to our podcast at greensensefarms.com.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Something we've learned on Green Sense is that regulations aren't the only way to improve the environment. Here's a case in point. Coal power generation, which saw an incredible drop, not because of laws and regulations, but economics and the availability of cheaper, better alternatives. It's something covered in the research by Dr. Harrison Fell, professor of resource economics with North Carolina State University. He joins us now. Welcome, Harrison.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There are some coal boosters who say it was regulations that brought U.S. coal down from 50% of power generation in the U.S. to 30% in 2013, but you say it's all economics because other options were cheaper. Which options were they, and how much cheaper were they?
Yeah, so we looked at particularly the role of low natural gas prices and increased wind generation. So natural gas prices really dropped due to fracking, and have become competitive now with coal. And wind generation has increased considerably from 2007 on. So those have been the two drivers that we looked at, and really it's been the gas fired generation that's pushed a lot of this.
Why didn't you look at solar?
So solar is still nationally pretty small. It's on 2% of the total generation, and a lot of that is concentrated in California, and California doesn't have really any coal fire generation to speak of. Wind generation is a much larger in terms of generation renewable than solar, and so respect that any of them is going to displace a lot of coal generation, it's likely going to be wind.
Were laws and regulations regarding coal a factor at all, or was it strictly that natural gas and wind were cheaper and more available?
Well, I'm sure that the regulations play a role, but what our model was showing was that we could explain a lot of the observed decline in generation from coal-fired sources due to the falling price of natural gas and the increase in wind generation. So I wouldn't say nothing is regulation is no part of this, but I don't think it's the large driver by any means.
Well, when you look at regulations, they can increase costs. For example, scrubbers to remove NOx and SOx on coal-fired power plants. Also, any process you need to remove the mercury and lead, and then the proper management and disposal of coal ash will all add to operating costs. And then there's the capital investment, you know, to put those in place. So regulations can clearly impact costs, but taking into account all that, you still think it was due to the economics of gas being natural gas being cheaper?
That's right. So once we control for a lot of those factors that we know about how these plants operate and the environments in which they're operating in, our empirical models suggested that the gas was the major driver behind the observed decline, and that wind generation was another factor, but gas price falling was the predominant driver.
Just as regulations can be an operating expense burden, incentives for any industry can be a positive enforcement to have a energy source be in favor. Did you look at incentives at all?
So there weren't a lot of incentives for coal-fired generation, which was really what we were focusing on. Clearly, there's been a lot of incentives behind renewable generation, and that's one of the drivers behind why we've seen the big increase in wind generation over the time span we looked at. And certainly as we think about solar now, that's a large part of the driver there. So we didn't have really incentives that were particularly important for the cases we were looking at, but yeah, in general, that is a major driver behind our renewable renaissance.
Your latest research covers the years 2008 to 2013. Any idea where we are at now with coal use for energy source?
So nationally, we're about 30% of our total generation comes from coal-fired plants. That's roughly about where we were, a little bit lower than what we were from the span that we analyzed. So we're kind of in the same space we've been in for the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, I recently toured a coal-fired power plant, and the thing that struck me was, one, how much capital investment is in these? You know, two, how old the technology is, and three, how slow they are to change because of that large capital investment and all the regulation and bureaucracy around those. I don't know how coal-fired power plants are going to remain efficient and competitive as new alternative, more nimble sources of energy come into play. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're correct. I think that it's going to be hard for coal-fired generation to remain a dominant source. So long as we have these persistently low natural gas prices and we continue to see increases in renewable generation from wind and solar, the future doesn't seem to be really in favor of coal.
No, and it's a dirty, polluting source of energy, even though it's readily available and it works pretty efficiently in all locations. I'm talking with Dr. Harrison Fell, Professor of Resource Economics, about the factors that have decreased the use of coal. Your research also presents wind power and natural gas as options that brought down the coal use. What about solar, nuclear, or other sources of power? Have they been a factor in coal's decline?
Well, again, regionally, solar is important in some markets, particularly California. It's been very big. And where I live in North Carolina, solar is a big part of our, or a growing part of our mix, though it's still pretty small nationally. I think going forward, solar will certainly be something that starts to carve into the share of generation from coal-fired generation. Nuclear, on the other hand, while we still have a lot of big nuclear plants, we're probably not going to see a massive increase in the number of nuclear generating facilities. And part of that is because it's really expensive to build a nuclear power plant. And when you have a lot of solar and wind and low natural gas prices on the market, that doesn't put the economics in favor of building nuclear generators.
Well, what happens if the price of coal drops precipitously and becomes cheaper than other sources of energy, or those other sources of energies rise in cost? Could we see a resurgence in coal-powered plants?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you mentioned, the capacity is out there. We have a lot of coal-fired generators. They're old, but they're big, and they're still there. And a lot of them are running at lower percentages of their capacity than they used to. And so if tomorrow gas prices start to go way up, natural gas prices start to go way up, that's going to present an opportunity for coal-fired generation to come back. We don't have a lot of strong environmental regulations. I mean, we do regulate some pollutants, but we don't have super strict regulations that are going to prevent that rebound for coal generation.
Let's talk about how regulations and economics can work together to get off coal. And a case in point is the province of Ontario, where the government made a commitment to get off coal in 2001. And we actually interviewed the Ministry of Energy here on the show. But can regulations be what got the ball rolling?
Yeah, certainly regulations can play a major role in determining what the mix of fuels will be. So for instance, if we were to put an aggressive price on carbon, that would really hurt coal-fired generation and tip the scales in favor of things like renewable generation and to some degree gas-fired generation as well, because you know renewables is carbon-free for the most part, and gas-fired generation is about as half as dirty as coal with respect to carbon. So regulation is not to be completely discounted. It can be a major tool for policymakers to sort of move the energy mix in the direction they want to. I would just say in our case, in the U.S.'s case, the change in our mix, particularly from coal to gas, has largely been driven by gas prices, not by any regulation.
Anything else in your research you'd like to share with us?
Well, I mean, you know, this has been a big topic, thinking about the generation mix and thinking about how it's going to go forward. There's a lot of other projects we have going on with this and thinking about the environmental value of renewable generators. You know, it's a really interesting area to be studying. It's extremely dynamic, and year to year we see major differences in how our generation mix is evolving, and it keeps us all on our toes.
What about the thought that large-scale generation and distribution is a thing of the past? We need much smaller power plants, you know, closer to the consumer, so that we don't lose as much through the transmission lines. You see that coming in the future?
I do think we will see more distributed generation. That's what we call this change from these sort of centralized power plants to these more solar on rooftops and microgrid operations. I think we're going to see that. I think we're going to see that because the cost of those generating sources has fallen a lot, and because there are some opportunities for improved reliability and potentially even some improvements in the cost. That said, I don't think it's going to happen overnight. I mean, this is a system of generation and distribution that was built up over many, many decades now, and turning that ship is going to be no small feat.
Well, thank you, Dr. Fell, for being on our show. Our show is all about, for it to make green sense, it has to make economic and common sense. And I think it's easy to understand that cheaper natural gas is an easy way to get off coal.
That certainly seems to be the case for us here.
Dr. Harrison Fell, professor of resource economics with North Carolina State University, joining us on Green Sense. This is Robert Colangelo. Subscribe to our podcast when you visit greensensefarms.com. As the global population increases, the need for more cost-effective environmental innovations that use less resources will increase. That's what we look for each week on GreenSense, innovators with sustainable solutions that make economic sense. Bob, what innovators have you found for us for the next show?
Well, next week we're jumping across the pond yet again. Seems like we have a lot of British people on lately. This particular British outfit has an idea of what to do with all that plastic waste that's just been sitting there, so we'll find out more.
I bet our guest pronounces asphalt a little different.
As in aluminium as well.
Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and you can check out the list of radio stations that air our show. We know you have a lot of choices, so thank you for listening. Stay fresh. Keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.